Please. I didn't get that one right. Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
Welcome back. So, now we're going to look at step two. You know, there's like a hallway between step one and step two. And when you're sitting in that hallway, right, the hope is that I've seen enough about my own experience, enough truth about myself to see that I'm in a desperate state. If I stopped right here, just being clear on what was wrong with me, I've got to see that would be problematic, right? But just the truth about alcoholism is not enough to keep me sober, because all I've seen is the truth of what was killing me. What is it that I need an act of God to save me from? So I'm sitting in this hallway in between. I've walked through this out the door of step one in a place of desperation, you know, and now I'm looking at this idea of step two, where we look at it in a chapter called We Agnostics. Now, the chapter isn't called We Believers. Right. If I come to step two full of God, then what do I need step three for? Right?
Exactly.
That doesn't mean that you may not have a conception or an idea of God going into step two, because many people have a belief in God. Right? But if I had any kind of reliance on that God, I wouldn't be here in the first place. Right? I wouldn't need to be doing this. Right? The reason that I'm here is because whatever place that I'm in, right, the power that I'm relying on is insufficient. So that's why this is it's so great to look at this from this perspective, because it'll work for believers and the non-believers, right? Because the thing that they have in common is obviously the non-believer doesn't rely on anything but himself, but a believer that's living an agnostic temperament is probably relying on themselves, even though they have a belief in God, right? And I think a lot of people can relate to that, right? Just because somebody tells me that they all about God. I mean, I've worked with people that know way more about religious ideas and concepts than I do. But the thing that levels the field here is what have I been relying on, right? Because whatever it is, it hasn't been enough power. It hasn't been enough. So, which brings us to this statement here on 45, which is lack of power. That was our dilemma. That we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Notice that the P is capitalized in power. Right? Small P is me, large P is God. So, because it says lack of power, it's a small P. Right? My lack of power. And we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a capital P power. So with that dilemma, doesn't mean just a problem. Lack of power isn't just my problem, it's my dilemma. The great definition I found in the dictionary is a dilemma is faced with alternatives that I don't necessarily like or want. Right? That's what makes it a real problem and a real dilemma, because I'm faced with ideas that I don't necessarily like or want. But I've been cornered into this place because I've come out of this hallway out of step one knowing that the truth of step one, I'm brought to this place where I have to be clear of what my insanity is. Right? And my insanity is what continually takes me back to the drinking, and my spiritual separation, as long as it's there, is going to continue to bring me back to that place. Right? So I'm moved into step two, being clear that my insanity is going to kill me. Right? But I have to find something that will restore me to sanity, and where is that going to come from? Right? So, lack of power, that was my dilemma. Interesting, though, based on that definition, faced with alternatives that I don't like or want, it gives me two alternatives in the page before. It says, doomed to an alcoholic death, I don't want that, or to live on a spiritual basis. How do I get that? God's never seemed to work in my life before. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous having lost everything. Where's God been? And I'm not, and I had all kinds of prejudgments and doubt about spiritual terms, and when they talked about spiritual basis, I heard religion, right? That was certainly not something that I wanted or thought I could have in my life. So these were not always easy alternatives to face. Doomed to an alcoholic death, or to live on a spiritual basis. And face it, only an alcoholic will have to consider that.
The thing that happened to me with this and why it was great that it wasn't We Believers was the fact that when I was very young, 9 years old, I was in a foster home in Compton during the riots in the 60s. And I was white, and everybody else was a little darker than me. And I was kind of like a target. And I used to pray in my pillow every night till it was soaking wet for God to remove me from this situation. And it didn't happen. I mean, guns were going off. People were getting killed. You could hear screaming and fires and smelling burnt tires and buildings. And it was just a 9-year-old kid in the middle of all of that. Was horrific, I got to tell you. And because of the way we agnostics is laid out, and looking at my lack of power as my dilemma, that I'm separated from God, I was floored, because I didn't believe in God. I actually saw that I was an atheist at this point. And that was a piece of truth, another piece of truth, another spiritual experience, that I was atheist and I didn't believe in, in logic and myself, and that I was in control of everything, because I grew up that way. There was no father, mother, no heroes or any of those things.
So, it's interesting that Bill's story is set up a lot like the whole book, right? The first half of Bill's story is basically that arch, when he started to drink, how his life progressed, how things started to turn in his life, and then how things started to crumble, and he struggled with his drinking, right? That was the first half of Bill's story. But then from 9... this book. You got more notes in this book. From page 9 to middle of page, actually the top of page 13, Bill talks about his fight against the idea of God, his struggle with that, his resistance. You know, and it's set up a lot like the rest of the book here, because from page 44 through to 47, actually into 53, it'll talk a lot about my resistance to the idea of God, right? My fight against it. I grew up in a household that wasn't religious at all. In fact, we had a lot of windows in the house, and I remember being really young, and you'd have the people that came and knock on your door to preach to you, right? And my mother would, because we had a lot of windows, my mother would make us hide behind the couch. Because she didn't want us to open the door for the people, and didn't want them to know we were ignoring her.
And this is a really good place to look, where the set-aside prayer becomes very, very powerful. Because I've had all these old ideas about God and the non-existence of this God. And I'm saying the set-aside prayer, God, please set aside everything I think I know. And just that in itself is powerful. So I needed that prayer in this moment for me to... I couldn't get rid of my old ideas about God and religion and so the set aside prayer was really powerful for me in this moment.
And I grew up in a household where there was a lot of fighting going on. My parents got physical on a regular basis with each other, not so much with the kids. They were pretty level-headed with us boys, but amongst each other they were, you know, it was rough. So I remember I must have been 7 years old. I remember laying there praying, asking God to keep them together and asking Him to stop them from fighting. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there was nothing there, you know, even though I was, you know, the schools in, I was living in England at the time, and the schools were a little bit more religious, and they would walk us around in these churches to go into services, right? And the churches in England were different than here. Here, old is what, 100 years? You know, there, you know, a new church is 500 years old or something like that. I don't know exactly, but it's hundreds of years old, right? So, and the church is designed a certain way. You walk in and it's massive, right? You got the colors and coming through, the sun coming through the stained glass windows, and you know, you feel this, you feel something. They're designed for you to feel something. And I thought, you know, and I'd go home and I'd try this prayer thing, and it wasn't working. I got nothing I asked for. even the puppy I had to really, really sell my parents on. Right? But I grew up, that's the way I grew up. I grew up believing that if I was going to get anything in this world, it was going to be based on what I could get out of the world, what I could negotiate, what I could force out of the world. This idea of God, it was really difficult. I had a lot of fight against that, a lot of resistance. And from that place of resistance, you couldn't talk to me about God, right? And there was no chance of any kind of spiritual shift in me if I stay in that place where I'm going to resist the idea of God, right? But step one, and the desperation that was attached to that for me, went a long way in cracking me open to be at least at this place where I'm open to the idea. And what I do with the agnostics, I go through all of the agnostics underlying where can I relate to not relying, being in a place where I haven't relied or don't rely that there's a God that'll work in my life. And it's interesting that underlying where I don't believe or can't believe seems to leave me with a little bit of idea of where I can believe, right? In the past, I've always been put in situations where I had to figure it out. In this situation, I was asked to underline where I don't believe, right? So I was given the opportunity to focus on what my difficulty with it is, rather than coming up with an idea of God. For me, that worked better. I know that people do this. People come to step two in different directions, but for me, in order for me to get to this place where it talks about on 47, versus we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself?
Capital P.
Capital P. Because for me to even be willing to believe means that I've shifted direction. I've put down the fight against why it can't work, and I'm opened up to the idea of how can this work. Right? I don't have it yet. Right? I don't have this. You know, it talks about when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. Right? They haven't pushed anything on me. Right? So I'm dropping my guard here. Right? I'm dropping the fight.
Right. That's exactly how the set-aside prayer started to work for me here, that I was losing this whole idea, and what Dan is talking about is that this is set up to see where you don't believe, and that's how I found out I was an atheist. I was marking everything in my book where I didn't believe, and terms and statements and sentences and even paragraphs that described my disbelief, and it wasn't hard to do that. And then I had to take a look at how could I come to a place of belief? How could I come to believe and mark statements and questions and paragraphs that would do? One thing that stuck out for me, you know, I always heard in Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, you just live life on life's terms. Live life on life's terms, and that's why I drank, because I was living life on life's terms. But here on the bottom, on the bottom of 46, there's a really great statement. We found that God doesn't make too hard a terms for those who seek. So now I'm going to be living on God's terms. I'm going to start living on rather than life's terms. Life terms suck. People die. You get sick. You know, there's just life terms suck. But how do I get through of that? Is that I start to realize that God doesn't make too hard a terms. So I'm going to live on the terms of God from this point on. And those were some of the statements that came where I could come to believe. Where I could come to believe, you know.
53 is a really important consideration. It says, when we became alcoholics, like when I really see step one, I'm crushed by a self-imposed crisis that I couldn't postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he's nothing. That either God is or he isn't. What is my choice to be? This is what I do when I work with people here is we don't rush through this question. I do a little exercise. Those who have experienced it know it's fun. Basically, it says either God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. The way I read that is either God is everything or I'm everything. Either God is or I am. What's my choice to be? I've heard this described a lot of different ways, but that's how what sits right with me. What we're really looking at here is either God's going to run my life or I'm going to run my life, right? And I have to remember we've already looked at how good a job I've done so far. But I take that into meditation, and we spend it's a week long meditation, and I have people I work with sit for about 4 days with the idea that what if God, what if there is no God, right? What if that little voice in the back of my mind that tells me there is no God is true? What if all you people that are talking about God, are really just lip flapping, and you don't believe it either, right? So I go back to page 52. I use page 52 in step 1. I use it in step 2. I use it in step 3, and I come back to it in step 11. So it's just a good way to look around my life. And it's like, so the idea here in the middle of page 52, where it gives me those considerations, what if the little voice in the back of my mind that tells me there is no God is true? And where it talks about having trouble with personal relationships. You know, what if I'm never going to have any more power than what I've ever survived on? Is going to be the only thing that is there for me? What if there's nothing more for me? I couldn't control our emotional natures. What if that little voice in the back of my mind that says there's no more power for me than what I've been operating on, and there really is no God, what is that going to look like with my emotional natures? Remember, emotional natures is what's going on emotionally inside. Not the face I'm showing you, but what's going on underneath that. And what about being prey to misery and depression? What if there really is no more power for me in my life than what I've ever had in the past? The idea that there's a God that can move me beyond that is a nice idea, but not real. Right? Couldn't make a living. Feelings of uselessness. Full of fear. Unhappy. Couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. What if that little voice in the back of my mind that says that there really is no God is true? Right? And I contemplate those things in meditation and truthfully it's those aren't happy thoughts. It doesn't bring up it brings up its own level of desperation, right? Because what if there is nothing more for me in my life than what I've ever had up to this point?
That's a really great place to be. It sounds kind of horrific, but what a great place to be that I have this question in the back of my head, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Why can't I just be a better person and not drink and be more attentive to my daughter and my son? My daughter and my son got to see me homeless in the same neighborhood. What's wrong with me? Why am I doing that? So page 52 started to give me an idea what was wrong with me. And the great hope was that I couldn't do anything to change it. See, I used to have hope that I could do something to change the way my life is. Now the great hope is that I'm out of the equation because I've already seen what I do on my own power. So I'm sitting here looking at this and it's given me hope because you don't have to change for me to be okay. You don't have to change. My attitude towards you has to change. And the only way that can be changed is with a God of my own conception, as they said before. So lack of power is my dilemma. Where and how are we going to find this power is right here. We're going to find this power. They're going to show us exactly how to find this power. So I don't go into the second step in a good mood. I got to have some sort of something that's pushing me to actually see that I want, again, it's a life and death errand.
So then, with the people I work with, we meet once a week. So I've given them 4 days of what if God is nothing. It's not uncommon for me to get a phone call right after saying, I don't want to do this. And it's like, especially the people with the big belief in God, it's, I can't do this. And it's like, why not? It's the way you're living anyway.
why now is it so difficult?
Yeah, why all of a sudden now it's a problem to consider? And it's like I'm sure that God is not going to be too harsh on you for trying to do an exercise that'll get you closer to
him. Exactly. It's like how well has your religious belief kept you sober? Can it keep you sober? There's nothing wrong with having a religious belief, but looking at where you stand with that and how it's worked for you, can it keep you away from the first train?
Religious beliefs go a long way, but how much do I rely on that belief? It becomes the bigger question. So with that, you know, the next 3 days of the exercise is, what if that little voice in the back of my mind is wrong, and that there is a power that can work in my life? I already see people smiling. You know, when it comes to personal relationships, you know, what if there's a power that can come into my life that I can actually access that power and bring that into my relationships and experience relationships from a place of having more power than I've ever had before? Right? What about with my emotional natures? Right? You know, what if I can rely on a power enough to be able to go inside and tap into that power that'll move me beyond those problems of the emotional things that are going on inside of me? And the being prey to misery and depression. What if that little voice in the back of my mind that resists the idea of God is wrong, and that a simple reliance on God could go a long way to move me out of that place of misery and depression? What if there is a spiritual place that I could be where I can make a living that's satisfying enough to keep me happy or sober? Nothing to do with how much money necessarily I'm making, but just having a life that I'm content with, right? Which is shouldn't be confused with being settled for, right? Because sometimes it's not really a matter of how much money you're making, but are you happy with the life that you have? Right. No matter where, at what point you're at with your life, feelings of uselessness and full of fear and unhappy and unable to, can't seem to be a real help to other people. You know, what if there really is a power that you could access and bring into your life that could help you with all of these things? Right. You know. Now, what is your choice to be? God is everything, or I'm everything. God either is or he isn't, right? And I'm asked to make that choice, not necessarily based on something that I have, but I've been moved out of a place of disbelief and resistance and prejudgment to a place of is. There's something here that I need in my life and want, right? I don't necessarily at this point know how that's going to happen, right? You know, but certainly I was assured that continuing on with this process is going to help me with that, right?
So the further on in this, you know, they talk about logic is great stuff on the top of page 53, and we like it, and we still like it. So then he goes down further. He says, hence we are at why we think our present faith is. Why we think more sane and logic to believe than not to believe. Why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy. When we threw up our hands in doubt, we said, we don't know. And that's the hardest thing for me to say is I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why my thinking can't cure me from this idea of going out and drinking. So my present faith is soft and mushy. It's just I get to see that, but I was more deep into it as far as being an atheist. It was a little easier for me to see that there was nothing there. But then, you know, there's other people who have all this faith and but it's soft and mushy. It's not that it's bad, it's just that I'm not connected, that I can't grab a hold of it. And being crushed by self-imposed crises, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition. And I think that's what's important, is fearlessly face it. And what makes me fearless is my first step. My first step makes me fearless to face this proposition that without God, if I'm everything, God is nothing. If God is everything, then I exist, basically, is what I started to experience with this. So then I start to look at how small I am in the universe, that I'm just this insignificant dot in the universe. And that isn't to, to have that, that's the truth. What can I say? That's the truth. I'm an insignificant dot in the universe. And therefore, I need this God to guide my life now, so that I can be useful to the people, that the fear starts to move away. I start to move away from fear. And I have so much emotion about this. I apologize. This was a very powerful moment in my step work to really make this proposal that God is everything or nothing. If he is, there he isn't, and without him, I'm nothing. And I started to see that very clearly. But the problem was how do I come to believe in a conception of my own? We're going to start looking at, you know, the conception of God that I need to move into the third step.
Talks about after we've looked at this, God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What is our choice to be? If I've been moved into this place where I see that if God isn't, if there is no God, then I'm screwed, right? But it goes on to say, on 53, arrived at this point, we are squarely confronted with the question of faith. Right. Okay, because now I've been open to the idea that there's a power that I have to have in my life, right? But I've still got these ideas that I don't have the ability to have faith, right? I don't have the ability to worship a God, right? I mean, just the word worship brought up tension in my mind. The book goes on to talk about some interesting things that I had never thought about. It talks about how we've been worshipers, but what if I've worshipped in the past? I've worshipped things. I've worshipped money. Right? I've worshipped relationships. If I had this relationship, then everything would be fine. If I had this much money, then I'd be comfortable. If, you know, if I had these things in my life, then I'd attract her. You know, it's like, and I see that even though I don't like the word worship, right? I've worshipped a lot of things, and those things. I don't like the word faith either, right? But haven't I been faithful to the God of reason? You know, on 54, that's capitalized, God of reason. I've been faithful to I've had faith that a lot of things would fix my life, would fix me. Right? The thing is that I've just never had faith or worship in anything but things and these ideas that were people and money and things and myself. I've worshipped myself. I had faith in myself, but I've never had that towards a power other than myself. Never had that in a God. Right? So I come out of this realizing that I do have the ability to have faith. I do have the ability to worship. I just have never directed that towards anything like a power greater than myself. Right? So I basically come out of step two seeing that I have to find some kind of faith and some kind of ability to worship something other than the things that I've depended on, other than the things that I've relied on in the past, right? So, with that, it leads us into step three, unless you have something else you want to say about step two.
Yeah, there was a statement here also on the in the squiggly lines on 56. Who are we to say there is no God? And then I start to come to that position and that kind of thinking. Who am I to say there is no God? Because God saved my life through Compton. God saved my life through the alleys that I was drinking in. I mean, I started to look at it in that perspective, that God was always there protecting and saving me. He didn't give me the big house on the hill with the picket fence, but I want this Santa Claus God before, and I wanted to do things for me and give me the things that I think are going to make me happy. So I'm always reaching out. I'm grasping a hold of everything outside of me. And now I'm starting to have an inner experience. My alcoholism has beat me into a state of reasonableness. I'm starting to look at this idea of a God in my life, and I need to know what I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of. In the past, I came into a meeting, they said, because you're here, you did the first step. Do you believe in God? And I was afraid to say no. And so then they said, well, just let's do a third step, and I'm trying to write inventory, and there's no power. There's no power. So I'm just powerless trying to write this inventory and having nothing to connect to. So all of a sudden, now we've got something that has depth and weight here.
So I start to look at step three and how it, in the chapter, how it works. So I think it really really important part of this, there's a lot of important parts, but I think what I'm wanting to start talking about is on 59, where it says half measures availed us nothing. Right? I can't halfway believe that there's a power that's going to help me, and then halfway believe that I'm going to be able to not have that power. Right? I have to be completely committed to the idea that there is something that will work here. Because it follows that by saying we stood at the turning point. Now, that for me was a spiritual experience, to stand at the turning point. And what I believe that means for me is I went from fighting the existence that there's a power that can work in my life to the point where I'd argue with you that there is no God. And I completely turned, and now I'm saying, how can I find this? How can this work in my life? I have been completely turned around, and that's me standing at the turning point now. I've dropped my fight against it, and now it's like now I want this, and what do I have to do to get it?
Right, so the turning point, I can either turn back to alcohol, or I can turn into God. And that was the turning point for me. It was like, without God, I'm going to drink. with God, I'm going to have a solution to what's wrong with me. So, the idea, we ask his protection with care and complete abandonment. Abandonment. I'm going to give up everything here. I'm going to start looking at that. I've got to give God everything. I got to turn to God for everything, not half, like Dan was saying, not half measures. That I'm going to be protected by this power. It's going to give me the right thoughts and the right actions, and it's going to control my life. There's a statement in the, it says that we utterly abandoned ourselves to God completely. I mean, this is serious stuff here, and it's a big decision to make, because I'm going to make this decision, and the first three steps are a decision process that we do every day. The first step is, what's my problem? Oh, I run out of food in the refrigerator. Well, I'm going to think about what's the solution. We'll go to the store. And then I'm going to make a decision based on the problem and the solution. Right? This is a natural process that we do naturally, and everybody makes a big deal of the first three steps, but we do it every day. The problem, the solution, make a decision, and go into action. The problem, the solution, into action. So we're going to look at it, making a decision now, you know, and looking at, based on what I've looked at so far with my beliefs in God and that I've coming to believe, I'm going to start looking at making a decision to depend on that utterly and with abandonment. I love that word, abandonment. You know the definition of that? Do you have a definition of abandonment? I don't have one in my book.
I'm sure you can find it really quick.
No. Let's not do that. Go ahead.
But I get to this point where I'm completely open to this idea that there's a God, that there could be a power that could work in my life. But the way I came to this program completely atheist/agnostic, you know, so I really don't have that yet. I don't have that yet. I thought that in the third step I was supposed to have an idea of God, right? But all I've done is come to this turning point where I'm willing to do what they asked me to do to find this. So to me, to completely abandon myself to this is followed by the next paragraph where it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. That's how I abandon myself to God. It says, it uses the word suggested as a program of recovery. I think that the word suggested gets pulled out of context in some places. It says, this is what we've done, we suggest you do it too. Right? There's not a lot of flexibility there. It's not suggested as a program of recovery that you could do or do something else. It's, this is what we do. This is what we suggest to do the 12 steps. So I've heard it described as, it's like if you were learning how to jump out of an airplane with a parachute, right? I suggest you pull this, count to five, and then pull this cord.
Right, and the 12 steps are the 12 steps of the cord. Am I going to pull this cord and get into a solution, or be splattered on the ground? You know, it's a decision based on two or more options.
So I'm not going to read all the 12 steps, which is the lack of time.
I couldn't read this, by the way.
Oh, the type's too small?
Couldn't see it.
Need stronger glasses?
Yeah.
It brings us to this point with the ABCs, or description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures. My personal story before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. But I'm alcoholic and I cannot manage my life. But probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. Right? Obviously, that I'm alcoholic and cannot manage my own life is step one. But probably no human power could have changed that, could have relieved my alcoholism, step two. And that God could and would if he were sought. When I read that part, though, that brought up a big question mark for me. Right? What was different, though, at this point, is I didn't have to fight against the idea. Right? It was like, okay, show me. Right? So being convinced of that, says we were at step three. This is the first point in the book where it references a step, and from now on it's going to tell you which step they're talking about.
And I think Bill was just bamboozled us so that we would have to work with somebody else. Where's the first step? And where's the second? Oh, you know where it is? Would you help me?
Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we do? Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? And it's going to tell us exactly that in the next page. But there's also a lot of people don't realize that there's a requirement before taking the third step. It says, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. This is the first requirement that we be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. On this basis, we're almost in collision with someone or somebody, something or somebody, even though our motives are good.
So this is a good place to go back to page 52 and look at how well has my self-will worked with this. How well has self-will worked in my personal relationships? Have I been able to self-will myself out of my poor emotional natures? Have I been able to self-will myself out of being prey to misery and depression? And obviously, my own power has not been enough.
So, we're almost in collision with something or somebody, and I saw that in my first step, and I saw it with my separation from God, and page 52, personal relationships. I'm in collision with something or somebody. Prey to misery and depression. I was colliding with that. So here is a requirement, and a lot of people say there's no requirements in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's actually a couple of them to begin a journey into each step. This is the first requirement. That means there's more requirements.
Should I go on?
Yeah.
I can read this.
Huh?
Should I read some of this?
Yeah. Well, no, I'll go ahead.
I think I should.
Okay. No worries. No worries.
Because it's going to be more fun if I read this.
Oh, is it? That isn't self-propulsion, is it?
Yeah.
Something about here about self-propulsion.
Yeah, Sheldon is like the actor who wants to run the whole show. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and Dan, in his own way. If Sheldon's arrangements would only stay put, if only Dan would do as he wished, then the workshop would be great. Everybody, including Sheldon, would be pleased.
Exactly.
Life would be wonderful. And in trying to make these arrangements, Sheldon may be sometimes quite virtuous. Sheldon can be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing, right? On the other
Absolutely.
Hand, Sheldon can be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, Sheldon is more likely to have varied traits.
And that's important, varied traits. I can have little bits and pieces of all of this. It's not telling me that all these things are true, because my ego will separate myself from any of these things if they were to say this happens to everybody. But I have varied traits. I can be kind over here and mean over there. I could be looking like I'm kind with actually being mean underneath. You know, it's just like I start to mix and match. You know, it's like these shoes go really well with this shirt. You know, so I'm being kind. I'm being kind and considerate, but actually I'm being mean and egotistical with inside of me.
You got to realize that what they're talking about is from a place of me not only relying on myself, I have to exert a lot of energy to arrange the world how I need it, to get what I need out of this world, right? If I'm the only power that I can rely on, if I'm the only thing that I can rely on, right, then I have to fight for what I need to survive, right? So what usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well.
Sure.
Sheldon begins to think life doesn't treat him right.
Damn it.
Sheldon decides to exert himself more. Sheldon becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding and gracious, as the case may be.
Demanding and gracious.
Right. Kind of exert more of what already hasn't been working.
Right.
Still, the play does not suit Sheldon. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, Sheldon is sure that others, but Dan is more to blame.
That's right.
Sheldon becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is Sheldon's basic problem?
Dan.
Is not Sheldon really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Do you ever think of yourself as a people pleaser? Have you ever tried to please anybody if you weren't trying to manipulate something out of them? That's a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind, right?
That's the deal right there.
Is Sheldon not the victim of the delusion that he can wrestle satisfaction? Rest is like a form of wrestle, like force. Is Sheldon not the victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the workshop? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony?
And that's powerful. I really see that, you know, and I start to relate to this.
Me too.
And I start to see how I'm a producer of confusion rather than harmony, and in collision with Dan all the time.
Okay. So it's so I'm not only just the actor trying to be the director, now I'm also the producer.
Right.
Of confusion. So I want to jump forward here because of time restraints. In 62 it says selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. A lot of people latch onto that sentence,
right,
and pull it out of that sentence like that's all the sentence says. Right? But it's not just stopping there. It says that there's something underneath it.
There's a driving force. Yeah.
It's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. See, we have to see what's underneath that, and we're going to see that in inventory.
I think also I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-seeking, and self-pity. These are the driving forces of my selfishness and self-centeredness. And this is the root of my trouble. So this is what's grabbing a hold of me deep, deep down inside. And this is what holds me to my old ideas. So I have to, these roots have to be pulled out. So, what was I going to say? We are troubled, driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. A lot of people will say, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, and they stop right there also. Say, oh, there's 1,000 forms of fear. But it's also 1,000 forms of self-delusion, 1,000 forms of, or hundreds of forms of self-seeking, and 100 forms of self-pity. So all of a sudden now there's all these driving forces. This is like the fertilizer for the root of my trouble.
So, do you ever see anybody get up at a meeting and say, I don't know how this program works?
Oof.
Or they'll say, I don't know why this works? Right? Well, just directing to this paragraph at the bottom of 62, where it says, this is the how and the why of it.
Right?
So first it's going to tell me how the program works. This is how it works. First of all, we had to quit playing God. That's how the program works. Okay. Why does that work? Because playing God didn't work. It didn't work. So that's the how and the why of the program. That we had to quit playing God because it didn't work. So here's the decision. The decision is not the prayer. The decision is before the prayer. The actual prayer is an affirmation of the decision that we're going to talk about now. It says, next we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be the core director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. That's the consideration for the third step, right? There's six things mentioned here. Director, actor, principal, agent, and father and child. So what they're referring to here is a relationship. They're relationships. Like a director directs the actor, and the actor takes directions from the director. Right? The principal and the agent works on behalf of the principal. He'll be who the principal would have him be. Right? And then there's the father and child relationship. The child relies on the father to provide what he needs. And this is validated on the next paragraph. But what I consider here is that the idea that some people like to pick one, but what I like to do is look at these as three facets of one relationship. Right? Three facets of one relationship. Right? So the third step decision can be really simplified by asking three questions. First one in regards to the director and the actor. And this is how I look at the third step decision. All right. So how good a job have I done directing my life on my own power? Right. I haven't done a good job directing my life on my own power. Right. The other thing you hear people say is, I did the third step and took it back. There's nothing to take back here. I haven't done a good job directing my life. Right? There's nothing to take back there. Right? The next one is the principal and the agent. remember that the agent will be who the principal would have them be. It represents the principal. The agent represents the principal. So the next question is, how good of a job have I been being the principal? Right? Making you be who I would have you be. Right? I haven't been able to make you be who I need in my life to fix my life. How good a job have I done making me be who I would have me be? I haven't been able to do that either. So I have failed to be the principal. And there's nothing to take back there either. Right? And then the father and child relationship. The third question is, how good a job have I done providing what I need in my life to have the life that I want or feel like I need? Right? I haven't had enough power to provide what I need. So the consideration here is that my third step decision is based on me being in a place where I'm willing to turn to God to direct my life, to help me be who God would have me be to myself and to you, and that I would rely that God the Father will provide what I need if I turn to Him. So there's three different aspects to one relationship.
And that's really powerful. That's to have something substantial that's going to run my life. It has to have some depth. I mean, when I came into meetings back in the 80s, people were worshiping doorknobs and light bulbs, and it was like, what is that? You got to be anything, but it's got to be it has to be something I can rely on. Now, the father and the child, I never had a father, and I never had a mother, so that was a very powerful moment for me to look at this as a father-child relationship. I latched on to that idea really well. I wanted a father to love me and guide me and in good times and bad times. And I wanted everything, my conception became everything that was unrealistic that I wanted from a human being. I wanted people to be understanding of my needs and to fulfill my needs and to do all the things that I craved to have a better life. And people never provided that for me. People hurt me. They put me in bad situations. People sucked, you know, and it was just like I really had a hard time relating to people after the end of my drinking. So now I'm going to have this intimate relationship. Father and a child is a very intimate relationship. It's something that can be very close if it's healthy and all of those things. And I saw that with Eddie's father and all these different shows on TV. I wanted that. I wanted that home life where everybody seemed to be rather happy and well fed and nurtured. So this God is going to become that for me. This God is going to become the father that's going to direct me and guide me protect me. That's what I always seen a father as. So now this is substantial. This is what I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of. Right? I need to know what it is. Right, Dan?
Mm-hmm. So, what you find too is that some people have a problem though with the idea of a father concept of God,
right.
But the truth is that I also have a problem with the principal being or a director being my idea of God, and I have to get around from behind the description and realize that they're talking about a type of a relationship. That those are just ideas of a type of relationship, right? It's not about making God a director. It's not about making God a principal
or a father.
Or a father.
Yeah.
But about being in a place where I'm willing to make the decision that God will direct my life, help me be who I would have me be, and to me and to others, and that I'll be able to rely on that. But I got to this point here, being the atheist that I was, still not knowing what that's going to look like. You know, because at this point, I really didn't have an idea of what God was. So, and I just bring that up because I know that a lot of people are just like that. That you don't have to be hung up on the idea that you're supposed to know what this is supposed to look like at this point. And you know, that this is at this point is just a decision. Do you want to talk about it just being a decision?
Yeah. A decision is not action. I'm not taking action here. I'm just, all the considerations I did in the first step to look at my alcoholism and why am I an alcoholic. Once I start, I can't stop. And when I stop, my mind takes me to the next drink. We looked at that, right? And then physically and mentally, and then I looked at the unmanageability of my life. I'm separated from this power. And page 52 is just popping out in my life. So now I make a decision based on the two things that I looked at. The first step is the problem. I'm powerless over alcohol. And powerlessness means powerlessness. I have no power to stop. I have no choice. I have no control over if I drink again or not. Then I look at the solution. Where do I stand with God? Well, I'm an atheist. I don't believe that there's a God that can do anything for me, and I need to depend on my own logic and everything. So therefore, I'm going to make a decision based on those two options, the solution and the problem. The problem is I can't drink, and I'm going to die, or accept this spiritual way of life that's going to direct my life and be the principal and the agent and all of these things. But it's just a decision. There's three frogs on the log, and one decides to jump, and you ask yourself how many frogs are on the log. Well, all three of them, because he only made a decision to jump. So therefore, we're going to make a decision. That doesn't mean we're going to do anything. The third step prayer isn't about doing anything. It's about making a decision to do something. And this is where I start to slack away from the third step, or the set aside prayer. Now I'm moving into something else. I've set aside everything I think I know about God, everything I think I know about the physical craving, the mental obsession, and now I'm convinced that I need this thing at this point, and that alcohol has beat me into this state of reasonableness. So now I'm going to just make a decision, and after a decision, then comes the action. You know, I don't believe in that I do the third step prayer the third step every day. I do this and then I move on to the next step. I do this. I don't take this back. How strong is my God that I can snatch anything back from it? It better be stronger than booze. God better be stronger than booze, right? Better be stronger than me and my mind. So how could I snatch it back and give it and snatch it and give it and snatch it? I don't understand that kind of thinking. Because once I turn my will and make a decision to turn my will and life over to care of God, and I do the steps necessary to do that, because 4 through 9 is how I do that. How do I turn my will and life over to care of God? 4 through 9.
And it says that at the end of the third step prayer on 63, where it says we thought well before taking the step, making sure we were ready. That we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. The way I abandon myself utterly to God is by finishing the process and living in 10, 11, and 12. So with that, our time is up. So we are going to continue at another location. I guess I'll let Teddy talk about that.